Excellency 529.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Romance and intrigue are as old as humanity. Georges Bizet's opera The Pearl Fishers is a lot younger, but it's getting a bit of a technical update in Opera Carolina's latest production. We'll find out more about that in the second half of our program. First, though, the Charlotte Symphony is getting in on the contemporary fascination with competition, taking a page from The Voice. And we can't say this legally. Well, they can't, but I can. American Idol. They are staging a competition of their own called Classical Idol. I wonder where that name came from. That caught our attention, so we're going to get a preview of what they have in mind. We're joined by Jackie Slogenhaupt. I almost got it right. Jackie Slogenhaupt, the chair of the Symphony's Classical Idol Competition. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Catherine Connor is the past chair, and because they had the symphony had their inaugural version of this last year, and she joins us as well.
Yes.
And two of this year's competitors is with us. Alan Black practically needs no introduction. He's the orchestra's longtime principal cellist and one of the founders of the city's chamber music series. He's appeared as a soloist and or fellow musician with people like Yo-Yo Ma. So it makes you wonder, why put yourself on the line? Why compete? We're going to find out. Welcome, Alan. Good to see you again. And also with Alan is one of his students. I wrote your name down, Drew. Drew Dansby. Drew Dansby is with us. You're 12 years old.
Yes.
And you're out of school. And you're competing with Alan?
Yes.
On the cello?
Yes.
He's your teacher?
Yes.
Boy, the heat is on, isn't it?
The heat's on me. Are you kidding?
We'll talk about all of that in a second. This is the second iteration of Classical Idol. Where did the whole idea come from? And I'll start with you, Catherine, because I know that you played a big role in coming up with this last year.
Oh, thanks, Mike. We're glad to be here. The Guild and the Charlotte Symphony work hand in hand, and we wanted an event that told the story that music transforms us, it transforms our community, and the CSO is the instrument of that change. And after a lot of brainstorming, we came up with the concept showcasing the talented Charlotte Symphony. We've got Maestro Christopher Warren Green behind us. And we wanted the experience of a wonderful show with competition and showing the Charlotte Symphony musicians in a non-traditional way. And Jackie can tell you some of what we're going to hear.
So Classical Idol is not just classical music. It's all genres of music, from pop to Celtic to jazz.
But why? It's called Classical Idol.
Well, because we're showcasing musicians in the city that are typically playing symphony or instruments. So it's, classical in that way. And so but we wanted to showcase the musicians in a way that people don't normally see them.
Yeah.
It's designed to be fun. It's designed to be exciting, designed to be different.
You were a contestant last year, Alan, were you not?
Yeah.
How'd it go?
It was fine. I was in a larger ensemble, so it wasn't so much about me.
What was the reaction of the musicians? Because, the musicians in the symphony, they're a conservative bunch.
Some of them,
Of them, yes. What was their reaction when Catherine and others came to them with the idea and encouraged you to compete?
Well, I think that they generally thought it was a great idea, and I think one of the reasons why we all thought it was a great idea is because we really do want to have people see us outside the normal, to see us as regular people and not just up on stage in tuxedos. Mm-hmm. And this was a great way to do that and is a great way to do it. And so I think that we think it's a great idea. And
The literature says, this is, and I quote here, the symphony wanted to showcase musicians doing unusual and extraordinary things. Are they juggling? Are they twirling fire batons?
No, they're not juggling. But you have to remember, the Charlotte Symphony family is composed of about 500 people. Mm-hmm. We've got the classical musicians we all think about in the Belk Theater. We've got the administrators who are often musicians or performers themselves. We have the oratorio singers. We have the youth orchestras, the junior youth orchestras. And, of course, Drew is the concertmaster of the junior youth orchestra. And so all of these people perform classical music in the Belk Theater, but they perform everywhere. They teach students. They teach in they perform in churches and synagogues on Sundays. They're in the schools. They're on the radio. And so these musicians, all 500 of these Charlotte Symphony family members, are out in the community being part of us.
How many contestants this year?
We have 8 contestants.
And 8 acts.
8 acts.
Excuse me. And how do they come to your attention? How do you choose them? I mean, you have to winnow it down, I would think.
Well, we definitely do. But we actually had an audition process this year. And we had people submit to be part of the show. So, and we wanted to have people come to us with new ideas and not just go in and assume that, you know, we wanted to tell people what to do.
So what caught
we wanted them to come to us with ideas that were interesting.
What caught your attention this year?
So this year we have one of our youth orchestra members playing a pop song on electric violin, where he does these really awesome loops. We have Leo Soto, who is our principal timpanist. He's doing a marimba piece. Mm-hmm. We have the War Winterfield program. They're going to be doing a Broadway show.
And that's Patricia's. Is that her first name? Not Patricia. I'm thinking of the dance theater.
Rosemary Furness.
Yes, Christopher Warren Green's wife.
So it's not just adults, it's adults and kids, and everyone kind of gets into the act and performs. And during the show, you have Jonathan Stewart, who's a running back for the Carolina Panthers, is coming on as a celebrity guest, and he's going to talk about how music impacts him and transformed his life.
I don't think people know that. He's a keyboardist and a composer.
He is.
What kind of music does he work with?
He does his own compositions. So it's a mix, and he is not even a professionally trained musician. He plays keyboard, but he attributes music in his life to helping him get to where he is today with his career.
And he has said that music will last far longer than his football career, which is probably true.
What an inspiration for the children of this community, for the leaders in this community, to see how music can impact a child, and that child can grow up to be a professional athlete, mm-hmm. Could grow up to be governor of the state of North Carolina, like Governor Jim Martin. Music influences us all in ways we don't even think about.
And you reference Jim Martin because he plays what?
Tuba.
And did he play with the symphony for a while?
I thought
years ago.
My understanding is he did a long time ago.
We need to turn our attention over here to two of the contestants. It's not often that we have contestants on this program. Alan Black and his student, Drew Dansby. Drew, you play the cello. It's probably bigger than you are.
Not quite.
But you also play violin.
Yes,
that's where you're the concert master of the Youth Symphony, correct? Which do you prefer?
Drew.
Careful, your cello teacher's sitting over here. Do you teach violin as well?
Or no.
Just cello? Okay.
Okay, I don't have a favorite, but but I get asked that a lot.
Do you?
Yeah.
You must have a favorite. They bring different things into your life, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Which do you practice more? Say cello. Cello.
Well, whenever I have a concert, mm-hmm. I have a bunch of concerts on cello coming up, so I tend to practice that a little more.
How long do you practice every day?
I don't practice every instrument every day because mm-hmm. I have to break it up. But I practice about 3 hours a week, 3 or 4 hours.
You said every instrument. Do you play more than violin and cello?
Yes, I also play the piano.
Good Lord. You're a prodigy. Alan, how did you choose Drew to be your co-contestant in this little effort here?
I've been teaching Drew for about 4 or 5 years, and Drew is an extraordinary young man, and he's my ace in the hole, because if I want to win, I got to have the best with me. And as a 12-year-old who plays a three-quarter-size cello, he doesn't even play a full-size cello yet. He has a command of the instrument that far exceeds anything anybody I've ever taught in 35 years. And he's just really an extraordinary young man.
When did that make itself known to you? When did you realize that was?
Right away, immediately.
Really?
And see, what's interesting is that Drew's mom called me up one day and said, that I'd like you to teach my son Drew, and we started talking, and she told me that he played violin, and I was like, well, I don't teach cello to violin students, because it's actually very different. It's like having assuming that a baseball player could be great at cricket or that a football player would be great at rugby. They're just really two different things. And so I agreed to teach him only after I went on YouTube and looked at a video of him playing when he was like 6 years old. And I thought, oh, I need to teach this young man. And since then, he's proven to be, both on violin and cello, a fantastic talent.
Was it your idea to take cello in addition to violin, or was that your mom's idea?
No, I just saw someone play, and I just decided I wanted to start, too.
A lot of kids your age have never seen a cello and never heard a cello and don't listen to classical music and have no idea what it is you're all about. How did you get there? Because obviously you're 12 now. You've been playing for how long?
About 7.5 years.
So you were 5?
I was 4.5 when I started.
Good gracious. So how did it come to you that you even were that you even knew about this kind of music, that you knew about the opportunity to play this kind of music and these instruments?
Yes, I just, like, at our church, I saw someone play. Yeah, like you said, not a lot of kids get to see someone play the cello.
I don't know how to say this because the technology changes so fast, but I'll ask you, what's on your iPod? What do you listen to?
I don't have a lot of music on there. I mostly listen to classical music on CDs or the radio.
What are you playing for this competition?
We're playing a piece by Piotti. It's a trio for two cellos and piano.
Mm-hmm. And how often do you get together with Alan to work on this?
Well, pretty much whenever we have a lesson, like once a week.
We actually have a rehearsal this afternoon with the pianist, with Dr. Paul Nitsch from Queens. He's accompanying us for this. So we have a rehearsal at 1 o'clock today.
You know, the heat is on here because Alan is the principal cellist with the symphony. If he loses, he's going to blame you.
Well, it's up to the audience, Mike. The audience gets to text vote for their favorite, so everyone gets to participate. And
That's even scarier. Come on. You're scaring me now, and I'm not even participating. Have you done a competition before?
Not like this one, no.
But you have.
But I have done competed? Other like competitions.
What makes this one different?
Well, it's most competitions I do are like auditions, mm-hmm. but this one is like where people vote for their favorites. So
I think for us, it's actually going to be more fun.
Yeah,
I mean, it's actually really neat for me to play with one of my students, mm-hmm. and we're playing a really difficult piece. We're playing like a college level piece. So it's great for me to interact with Drew, and I would assume that for him it's also great to interact with his teacher.
So he's kind of a ringer.
He is. He's my ringer.
That's exactly right. Yeah. What's the prize? What do you win if you win this?
Oh, that's a surprise.
Okay.
It is, but Classical Idol is this Friday at Spirit Square, and it's produced by the Symphony Guild, and I'd like to give a plug for the education programs that the Symphony Guild has, one of which is the Musical Petting Zoo, where children in lobbies and classrooms get to actually pick up real instruments, play them, saw on them, blow on the tuba, and all under the supervision of the army of volunteers in the Symphony Guild.
This is going to be on Friday evening at McGlowan Theater, right down the hall from us here at Spirit Square. And it's open to anybody who wants to come.
Tickets available.
And it should be worth the price of admission just to see this duet, or this trio, I suppose, play. Alan Black, the principal cellist with the symphony, and Drew Dansby, one of his students, 12 years old, a very obviously a talented kid and very bright. Thanks for joining us this morning. Catherine Conner and Jackie Slagenhoff, both with the host committee, the Symphony Guild host committee of Classical Idol. Once again, Friday at Spirit Square. We're coming back. We're going to find out about Opera Carolina's latest production of The Pearl Fisher. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the graduate engineering programs at UNC Charlotte, offering a Master's of Engineering Management program that delivers even higher education for engineers. Information at evenhighereducation.uncc.edu. And Creative Loafing, announcing the first annual Iron Fork event, April 17th. 5 local chefs compete for the Golden Fork Award. More at clclt.com/ironfork.com. 2013. For years, scientists have been talking about finding the so-called God particle. They built a super collider in Switzerland to help them in that quest, which, by the way, has huge implications for physics, for science in general, and for humanity and our understanding of the universe. But just understanding what they're trying to do and what that particle is bewildering. So we've invited Dr. Sean Carroll to talk about it. He's the author of The Particle at the End of the Universe, and I'm told he can explain it in English. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Jay and Reem Show, for our Mind and Body series, a new study finds that bacteria released when you eat red meat can damage the heart. Red meat and heart disease.
Join the Diane Reem Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Even for those who don't follow opera, they know Georges Bizet's most famous work, Carmen. It's a piece Opera Carolina has done many times in the past, but the composer's breakthrough opera opens next week at the Belk, The Pearl Fishers. That is perhaps among the best-known parts of the opera, and although you didn't hear him on that excerpt, Chad Johnson will be singing the tenor part of that duet as he plays Nadir in Opera Carolina's production of The Pearl Fishers. Did I get the character name right?
Nadir, that's
okay,
it.
Okay, close enough. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio along with Metropolitan Opera soprano Janina Burnett, who will be playing Leela. Thank you for being here as well.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And joining us by phone is General Director and Principal Conductor of Opera Carolina, James Mina. James, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Janina. Good morning, Chad. Good to talk to you all.
Good morning.
Well, now that we've all met, this is the last show of the season for Opera Carolina. How has it gone so far, James?
You'll have to ask the two artists in front of you because I've been out of the country for the last 3 weeks. Guys, how's it going?
It's going really well, actually. We had our first and only tech rehearsal last night, first time on the set, and it went very well. It's going to be a beautiful production.
First and only?
Well, it's our only time to really set places. It's our first time to actually get up on the set. The rest of the time was really more devoted to coordinating with the orchestra and coordinating lighting cues and things like that. So it was our first chance to kind of walk the set and just place ourselves in the right place so we don't die.
And don't fall into the pit.
Exactly.
Not recommended. But I was going to ask you, I was trying to ask James, how has the season gone so far? Has it been a good one for the opera?
Mike, this season has been fantastic for the opera. You know, we over the last 18 months, you know, we've really seen a turnaround in the economics, ticket sales, audience enthusiasm. And part of it, quite honestly, is that we've refocused the company's priorities. And ever since the fall of last season when we opened with Trovatore, you know, we've really invested more money and more of our resources into the quality of the product. Of course, we downsized from 5 productions to 3, and, you know, that helps. But I think the combination of a higher artistic level plus the turnaround in the economy has made for a really terrific season for us so far. So fingers crossed that Pearl Fishers is going to be another big success for us.
Now, you staged Carmen several times in the past, and I know that you've done the Pearl Fishers in the past, but how familiar are people with this, both in terms those who go to opera regularly and those who may only go when they hear an opera that they know.
Sure.
How familiar is this?
Well, there's a couple of moments that have become very famous. Obviously, the first is the duet, because there really aren't a number of moments in opera where a tenor and a baritone really get to sing together. So, mm-hmm. You know, Otello and Don Carlo and Pearl Fishers, and those are really the big three. So everybody knows and loves this melody.
Why is that?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's always a soprano tenor duet, and there's just a few moments. There's a small moment in La Boheme that the guys sing together, but to make a complete scene with two men, it just doesn't happen often. Mm. But then Nadir's aria has also become very famous, and they've even adapted it into some Russian liturgical music. His famous aria, which is insanely difficult but very beautiful, and so that's one of the fairly well known melodies from the Pearl Fishers as well.
So, given the fact that this is not as well known as some of the other operas out there, why did you choose to put it on the season, James?
Well, Mike, I mean, it's you know, what we've been trying to do with the season is balance out the very familiar. This season, for example, we opened with Tosca, which is, of course, a very famous opera that most people know, and then followed by The Magic Flute last January. So, you know, we try to balance the repertory by doing operas that are not so well known at least once during the season. Now, sometimes that's going to be a new opera like Margaret Garner or Cold Sassy Tree. Sometimes it's going to be an unknown work by a known composer like Eugene Onegin last season, and of course this season with the Pearl Fishers. We think it's important that I don't want to say educate, because that's, you know, kind of condescending, but we present works for the audience that are unfamiliar so that they can expand their operatic experience and their understanding of the art form. Pearl Fishers is a perfect vehicle to do it, because there's at least one tune that everybody knows, this great duet for the tenor and the baritone. But like Carmen, you know, this is filled with great melodies. And it's a moving, passionate story, just like Carmen. So I'm very enthusiastic. We actually did the Pearl Fishers in 2005. It was the first time we had ever performed the piece. So this is a redo for us. We've redesigned the production a bit. It's a production that we own, so we've added new projections, digital projections.
And by saying that this is a production that you own, you're talking about the set. You own the set, because nobody owns the script and the score.
That's right. I mean, the music and the script are in the public domain.
But you've taken the set and you've augmented this. Why it surprised me that you said you had your one and only technical rehearsal, because you've augmented this with technology that didn't exist in 2005 when you last did this.
Well, it kind of did. I mean, Chad was right. I mean, what last night was piano tech, but then there's technical rehearsal tonight, and then the next two evenings are with orchestra. So we actually get, four shots on stage for all the tech work, plus the crew has been in there working.
So what have you done? What have you done to this production in terms of the technical aspects that make it different?
Mike, it's pretty simple. You know, most opera productions are set pieces and then painted backdrops, mm-hmm. that enhance the images. And what we've done is replaced all of the painted backdrops with digital imagery, so that instead of having a static sunset, for example, we now can use digital imagery to change that picture over the course of an act or over a scene, so that we can go from sunset to, to a beautiful starscape, you know, within the confines of the same scene. Mm-hmm. So it adds, in this instance, a very cinematographic element to the stage setting.
Well, now you've performed, Janina, at the Metropolitan Opera, which is known for having incredible sets that wonderful stage up there. But not everybody can afford to do what the Metropolitan Opera does. Mm. And this is one way, I guess, to change it up a little bit and make it happen. Are other opera companies that you've worked with, either of you have worked with, doing this kind of thing? And how is it going over with audiences?
You know, I have not experienced it so much with other companies that I've worked with, but I have noticed that that all of the regional houses are really looking for ways to draw in new audiences, to draw in, you know, people who would not come to the opera otherwise, you know, and looking for other ways to tell the story. So I think there are innovative ways that are, you know, are developing, but I have not yet seen, other than at the Met, the digital use of computers and whatnot for sets.
You've done this a couple of times now in recent history, James Mina, where you've done some things with the setting and the costuming of an opera that really have updated it. Madama Butterfly, I think the Magic Flute this past season, and we know that we've talked about this before. What you did with Madama Butterfly and June Kaneko was stunningly beautiful, but a little off-putting to some people out there who wanted to see the traditional setting.
I thought I was going to be tar and feathered by our loyal conservative audience members. So, you know, that's the risk you take when you try to move the paradigm.
But if you don't grow and change and move forward, then you're going to stagnate and you're going to die. So how does this, what you're doing with this version of the Pearl Fishers, fit in what you did to Madama Butterfly and what you did to Magic Flute?
I think the Butterfly production and the Magic Flute production particularly were at the extreme scale of revisioning a classic work. We're not quite going that far with the Pearl Fishers. This is, in fact, quite honestly, people will notice the digital imagery, but it won't be as in their face as certainly the Magic Flute was. This is simply a way for us to accomplish two things. First of all, it allows us to go from scene to scene within the confines of the opera without those long scene changes that often we experience at the opera house. And that's important for keeping the audience's attention. It also helps us streamline the art form a bit. Pearl Fishers is a three-act opera. We're performing it in two acts. So in a way, we're updating the art form. You know, we're taking this 100-plus-year piece, the Pearl Fishers, and we're making it in a way, we're presenting it in a way that we think contemporary audiences will really enjoy because it fits the visual elements that folks have gotten so used to, you know, with movies and what have you. And it becomes more engaging visually as well as musically. And I think those are two things that are really important for a contemporary audience.
This is composer Georges Bizet at 24 years old. It's 12 years before Carmen. As you sing this and as you prepare for these roles, do you notice a difference in his approach to music, a passion or an exuberance or something different at all? Maybe you don't, from him when he 12 years later for Carmen.
Sure. You can tell that there was an evolution in the way that he composed. I haven't sung Don José yet, but it's on the docket for, mm-hmm. you know, down the road. And so I've done a little bit of study on that, but it's very clear that he was a little bit young and a little bit, you know, wet behind the ears when he wrote this. Some of the music kind of sounds like vaudeville kind of film music in some parts like that, but it's still very exciting and still really wonderful, and you can tell he kind of evolved a little bit away from that when he started writing Carmen and pieces down the road. But it's all very exciting. There's a nice span of music, and there's some really exciting dance music, and, mm-hmm. and he kind of draws on the exotic elements that they were trying to play, because this takes place in ancient Ceylon, which is now India, and it was just he tried to say how mystical and primitive these people were, you know, because they really didn't know very much about them,
right.
And so it's a Frenchman's, you know, take on what ancient Ceylon was.
And this is 1863.
Yes.
So they probably he'd probably never seen India.
Exactly.
Never been there.
Exactly.
Was this his first opera? I know he'd been composing since he was 12, I think. Mm-hmm. Was this his first opera? Do we know?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
No, Mike, he had made a couple of efforts with operas as a student, and none of them were really successful. This was the first real commission that he received to compose an opera. Mm. And at this time, you know, there were, not unlike what happens nowadays, there were several layers of theaters. You know, there was the Grand Paris Opera, which would be the equivalent of the Metropolitan Opera. And then there were opera houses that were more tailored toward young composers. People will kind of giggle at this, but, you know, in the 1860s in France, it was really hard for young French composers to make a name for themselves because, you know, the big theaters were very traditional. So this was actually commissioned by an adventurous theater in Paris, the Theatre Lyrique, the Théâtre Lyrique, which specialized in young composers who were cutting edge, who were doing stuff that, you know, that the big traditional houses weren't doing. And so what Chad was talking about, the kind of the vaudeville elements, Bizet actually draws from the operetta tradition because that was also something that was very popular and happening in these popular theaters. So that's why you have these elements that are very popular, kind of sounding light sort of music, which occurs during Pearl Fisher's as well as some of the grand pieces that he writes. So it's again, it's kind of cutting edge for the time, and it's really a great, great piece from my standpoint.
Now, Janina, you've sung Leela before. You sang it in Syracuse, and you were named Artist of the Year in 2011 by the Syracuse Opera for your performance in that opera. Aside from that, I understand this is one of your favorite roles.
Yes, it really is.
Is it connected to that award, or is it something
of
your favorite role?
No, it's something about this role that is just, I really connect with spiritually and just energetically, her commitment to love. But just to the way that it sings is quite fulfilling in that there's, you know, the coloratura element. And then as the role progresses, there's more lyric, fuller, you know, emotional, you know, I don't know, gripping singing that I really truly enjoy.
And you've said that this really fits in your voice very well. Explain that to people who don't sing.
Okay. It's kind of like I have to relate it to food. It's like, okay, your mom tells you to eat your vegetables and you do it. You do it because it's supposed to help your body, and it's a wonderful thing, but you really want to eat a cheeseburger, and a cheeseburger just really, you know, fulfills everything, your palate, it fulfills your full after, you know, it's kind of like that, I would say. So it's like after singing this role, I feel like I'm nourished, I feel like I'm full, I feel like, you know, and I've enjoyed it.
Does it take less effort because it's in your voice, it's all the thing, it complements your vocal characteristics, or is it just as difficult? It's just that something, it just feels good when
yes,
you do it.
Yes, it's just as difficult. However, something about the tessitura really sits, it's comfortable for me to sing.
Tessitura is, for those who don't sing.
Yes,
is.
Tessitura is the where the role actually sits in the voice, actually. You know, the note, I guess it's the note range, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, where the notes that it goes back and forth between, I would say.
And you've both done this opera in the past.
Yes.
And you've done it in a number of different places. When you travel around the country and you've got this under your belt, you've got this in your repertoire, and you work with different music directors and you work with different stage directors, are you asked to bring something different to the table every time, or are you expected to bring what it is that you bring?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always a collaboration. So every time you do it, you, even though you're singing the same notes and the same words, it's always feels like a completely different role because you have a different leading lady, you have a different a best friend in the show, and it just makes for the chemistry is completely different. But you still have to produce the same quality of singing and the same quality of product.
Yeah, and every artist has their own interpretation, and sometimes you have to kind of fit into what, you know, so that you guys are on the same page. We worked a lot on that in this show, trying to get on the same page.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we can have some fun. We have both of you singing. How we did this, I don't know.
Uh-oh.
But we've done it. We're going to come back. Opera Carolina's production of The Pearl Fishers opens April 13th. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Appalachian's Performing Arts Series, presenting Garrison Keillor, a brand new retrospective with special musical guests, April 16th, 8 p.m., Holmes Convocation Center in Boone, details at pas.appstate.edu. And the U.S. National Whitewater Center's Tuck Fest, April 19th through 21st, celebrating the outdoor lifestyle with races, competitions, demos, live music, and more, details at usnwc.org. For the Mind and Body series, which continues today at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, a new study finds that bacteria released when you eat red meat can damage your heart. Diane and her panel of experts talk about new findings on red meat and heart disease. And by the way, you can find information about both of the things that we're talking about today, both the classical idol and the pearl fishers, at our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. You know, it's springtime when thoughts turn to a nice, clean car.
Which in my case means someone else.
If you're ready for new wheels, donate your old ride to the station through the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program. For details, call 866-789-TMCP.
TMCP?
Yeah, take my car, please.
That's 866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Janina Burnett is with us, a Metropolitan Opera soprano and playing Leela in the upcoming production of Georges Bizet's The Pearl Fishers, April 13th, 18th, and 21st for Opera Carolina. Chad Johnson is the tenor playing Nadir. I'm not doing it right, am I?
No, you are. Nadir is exactly
okay,
right.
Nadir. Yeah. And James Mina joins us by phone from Canada. He's the general director and principal conductor, but I think he's moonlighting on with some other company. tell us a little bit about the story behind The Pearl Fishers. You're both in it. You're both the leads. So tell us what the story is.
I'll give you Cliff Notes version. It's Nadir and Zirga are best friends. They're both pearl fishers in a pearl fishing village, which is a very difficult profession. And they both fall in love with the same woman. They have these priestesses come in every season to sing on the shore, and they believe that that will protect the fishermen while they're down fishing for the pearls. And she has to take a vow of chastity and that she cannot be touched or in the presence of another man or see her face even seen. She's always veiled. And so I fall head over heels in love with her, and so does my best friend Zurga. So I decide to take a break, and I leave the village for a chunk of time and go to the jungle and learn some new trades. And I come back just in time for the arrival of what we think is the new priestess. And I see my best friend Zurga, and we say, you know, we'll never let that happen again. We are too strong of friends. We will always be together, and no woman will ever separate us again. And then Leela shows up again, and I realize it's her, which it depends on how you interpret it. I happen to arrive just before she gets there. It might have been planned. And as soon as I take that vow with Zurga, I run right to the cave where she is, and we fall madly in love. And the townspeople find out about it, and that means that we are sentenced to death. And so just before we are about to be executed, Zurga goes and sets his own village on fire, and all of the townspeople run away and forget about executing us. And Zurga says, all right, guys, you are free to go. Go live your lives together, and makes the ultimate sacrifice, and the townspeople execute him. And Leela and Nadir are sent off on the boat to live their lives together with Zurga dying on the
stage.
This
is like CSI Salon.
Exactly, exactly.
And you have the luck to sing the duet that we heard at the very beginning of this segment, Au fond du temple saint, which is called Deep in the Holy Temple. It's one of those arias that people know, and one of those arias that people come to the opera to hear, specifically. What's that like for a singer? Because that's a lot of weight to carry around. It seems to me that this is the moment.
Yeah,
here it comes.
It is.
We know it's coming. Do it.
Exactly. And that's exactly what you have to do. You have to be in the moment, and you have to be portraying your character at that moment and really communicating the relationship between you and Zurga to advance the plot point. If you were having your head, oh, this is what UC Buehling and Richard Tucker and Leonard Warren and everybody on earth have always sung and Bring the House Down, you won't even make it through, you know, if you have that kind of pressure. So it's a matter of staying in the moment and telling the story.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I know musical theater performers, the people that go to musical comedies and musical theater, they can be snooty if they're really into it. But they're nothing like opera people. Because opera people, I went to an opera once in Italy,
and they were throwing things.
Oh, but Italy's very different.
Yeah, there's a
all over the world, we all know as opera singers that in Italy, it gets serious. They boo, they will throw things at you, and that's for everything, yeah. Everything.
And I did an interview with one of these singers, and he was not well received when I saw the opera. They didn't like him. They were talking to him. And we were doing the interview in the alcove of a church outside. And people were coming by, and they were catcalling because they recognized
it. It's serious there.
It is very serious.
Yeah.
It scared me, I got to tell you.
Yeah.
Your character, Leela, is at the center of this love triangle between Nadir and Zurga. And at one moment in the piece, you sing an aria in which you long for how things were before things got so complicated. It's called Comme Autrefois.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that piece of music.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's actually, it comes in the opera when, at a time where Leela is told to just rest in the wilderness, basically in the dark. However, she's protected by, you know, the warriors of the village. However, she's very afraid. She's afraid because, you know, it's dark. She's afraid because things have changed in her life. This is a new circumstance. Who knows what's going on? You know, she's been prepared for the life that she's leading. However, the unknowns are still very frightful. So she sings this song to kind of lull her to sleep, which is evading her. The sleep is, and it kind of just relax her. You know.
Now, usually at this point, we have to play a version of this by some other singer because we don't have the actual guests who are singing with us at Opera Carolina. But in this case, we do have you. I'm not sure where this came from. It's a little off mic, but this is Janina Burnett singing that aria, Comme Autrefois, from The Pearl Fishers.
Sometimes it's nice, sometimes it's like,
because a lot of times I have singers in here and they just cringe. you weren't doing that.
Everything.
You weren't doing that. I'm glad to see that.
This is why I love my job, because I get to sing with that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I get to listen to her do that every day.
But we have you too.
Oh,
yes!
Boy.
This is not from this opera.
Okay.
But I went searching on the internet yesterday, and there's a little piece of you.
Uh-oh.
Singing part of a Stephen Schwartz opera. I didn't know, since Stephen Schwartz has been a guest on this program, I did not know that he had written an opera.
Yeah.
It's called Seance on a Wet Afternoon. And after we hear this piece, I want you to tell us what you're singing about. I think this is from a rehearsal documentary.
Yes.
Okay. This is our guest, Chad Johnson, with a piece from Seance on a Wet Afternoon.
What is my mission, girl? What have you done with my baby? Hello, hello. Yes, I'm listening. Yes, I'm not even ready. In a minute back, yes.
I'm enjoying the getting a fix.
Can you just repeat that last part, please? Can you just repeat that last? Hello.
The
This is one of those things that's a rehearsal video, and so you're not properly mic'd. But you know, opera singers are used to not having mics, but he just doesn't.
We prefer it.
It doesn't come across as well on video. But talk to me. That's from a it's based on a movie, isn't
sure.
it?
Sure. In that scene, my daughter has been kidnapped at this point, uh-huh. and I'm getting the procedure to pay the ransom and to pick her up. And, you know, he says, you know, bring this bag full of money to this location and that kind of thing. So it's actually a phone conversation. That I was having there.
Was this eventually done?
Yeah, they did it at New York City Opera, actually. I wasn't part of the New York City Opera production, but Stephen Schwartz actually called me personally. I never met him before. He got my name from someone, and I had a voicemail from Stephen Schwartz. And I said, oh, okay, well, sure. He said, do you have time to come and do this reading? I need a tenor with a high C, and you came recommended, and so that was that, yeah.
I've read that you, Janina, like so many other people who are performers and who are very comfortable performing at the Met or in a 3,000-seat house, don't like performing in front of small groups of people.
Yeah, it can be difficult.
Why?
Because you feel the energy of the audience so much. It's like a part of your performance, you know what I mean? As opposed to being on a stage where it's just you, you're isolated, they could be there or they could not be there. Whereas when you're very aware of them, they're in your space, it's just something you have to contend with as you create the art, you know? That's
And yet, you were asked to sing for Oprah's birthday.
Yes.
At Maya Angelou's home.
Yes.
And one of the things that I read that you said about performing for small groups is that you can look into their eyes, and you can, and that's disturbing.
Yeah.
So when you looked into Oprah's eyes, what was that like? Were you one of her favorite things?
Like looking into the face of God.
Well, I think by the time we performed, because I performed with a quartet of singers from Spelman, from our Glee Club, and I think by the time we performed, she was pretty comfortable. You know, the party had gone on, and, you know, she was really nice. I think she enjoyed it.
That's good to hear. So, James, talk about Bizet for a minute. A lot of people are, as we said, familiar with Carmen, and you mentioned earlier in this conversation that the music in this opera is just as lush as it is in some of his other works. But talk about him as a composer for opera. Are you there, James?
Sorry, Mike. Yes, I wasn't sure that was to me.
Yes, I'm sorry. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bizet's, the musical style is the same, very much the same as it is in Carmen. It's traditional from the standpoint of it's a numbers opera, you know, the arias and the duets and the overtures and the big choruses. And the big choruses, quite honestly, are one of the things that Carmen and Pearl Fishers have in common. The choral writing is actually fantastic in the Pearl Fishers. But what Bizet does, like his idol, who was Richard Wagner, is that he stretches the harmonic qualities to the point where it's not, you know, it's very romantic music. This is not classical writing like in the Mozart opera, for example. He really is pushing the envelope harmonically and with what he asks the orchestra to do. The orchestrations are stunningly beautiful. Chad mentioned this, the exotic nature of Bizet's writing. And, of course, Carmen, back in the 1870s, was an exotic setting of Spain. And, of course, in Pearl Fishers, the exotic setting of Sri Lanka. And Bizet captures that so beautifully. There are passages which are absolutely oriental in their flavor in the Pearl Fishers. He's really, you know, he was a prodigy. Musical prodigy, brilliant composer, and all of that comes through in the Pearl Fishers. The other thing they both share is that they're great melodies. This is extremely melodic, beautiful music.
We've talked in the past about bringing new audiences to opera, and because you've got to continually refresh the audience, otherwise they die. And we have two examples sitting in front of us in the studio here of two young people who are in opera as performers, as singers, as artists. What brought you to opera? How old are you? You're in your 20s, I take it.
Oh, God. I wish. No.
Okay, you're teens.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm 35, actually.
Okay, all right. So what brought you to opera and at what point in your life?
I've always loved opera. I remember being young enough that I was sitting on my mom's lap and watching Marilyn Horne, when she had black hair still, sing on TV. And I didn't know what it was, but I thought it was really interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that I liked it. I didn't know. I just thought, oh, okay. And so kind of for the rest of my life, it always just kind of piqued my interest. And I started studying voice in high school, mm-hmm. got a scholarship to college, did my first opera in college, and it kind of went from there. I enjoyed the study of technique, because, you know, when you're a singer, you can't say, you know, when you say breathe from your diaphragm, you have no nerve endings in your diaphragm. It's all kind of sympathetic vibrations and things like that. And I always found that kind of fascinating to try and master that.
And your mother was a poet, your father was a jazz drummer, and mm-hmm. you described yourself as a flower child, which is kind of from the 70s. What brought you to this as opposed to jazz?
Well, I intended to be a jazz singer when I got to college, but I also, in high school, I said, I don't want there to be any kind of music that I cannot sing. Mm-hmm. So it so happened that when I got to Spelman, classical music was a very... was the primary art form. I was like, I'm going to do jazz. But my friends in my freshman class, they all sang classical music. And they were wonderful at it. And they had come from places like D.C. and, you know, the East Coast. So I was very heavily influenced by this. So I found my voice in college, and I decided to continue with classical music.
Only a couple of opera singers that I know of have taken that excursion into contemporary pop music or jazz. And you've done it, and we have a recording of you singing a classic here, How High the Moon.
How high the moon is the name of the song. How high the moon, though the words may be wrong. We're singing it because you asked for it. So we're swinging it just for you. How high the moon, does it touch the stars? How high the moon, does it reach up to Mars? Though the words may be wrong to the song. For at
I don't know that I've ever heard of a sort of scat. You tried that with Bizet.
Eileen Farrell was a great jazz singer.
Yes. And by the way, Eileen Farrell used to sing with Lunas McGlowan. And McGlowan Theater is right down the hall here.
That's, oh, no kidding.
Yeah. How cool.
He did a number of albums with Eileen Farrell. Oh, he sing her praises
fantastic.
All the time. The Pearl Fishers with our two guests today in the studio, Chad Johnson, the tenor, and Janina Burnett, the Metropolitan Opera soprano. James Mina, the general director of the opera, joined us by phone. And the opera itself is April 13th, 18th, and 21st in the Belk. You can get information at operacarolina.org. Thanks all for being here. Appreciate
it. So much. My pleasure.
Thanks.